Now down to Morristown, the towns and villages had been thick with rolling mills, nail and spike factories, foundries and forging shops. Walcott showed him the site of the old mill in Boomtown where axles, wheels, and rails were manufactured for the original Mars and Essex Railroad. He showed him the powder company plant in Kenville that made dynamite for the mines and then, for the First World War, made TNT and more or less paved the way for the government to build the arsenal up at Picatinny, where they manufactured the big shells for the Second World War. It was at the Kenville plant that there had been the munitions explosion in 1940, 52 killed. Carelessness the culprit, though at first foreign agents' spies were suspected. He drove him partway along the western course of the old Morris Canal, where barges had carried the anthracite in from Phillipsburg to fuel the Morris foundries. With a little smile, Orchard added, to the sweet surprise, that directly across the Delaware from Phillipsburg was Easton. And Easton, he said, was where the whorehouse was for the young men from Old Rimrock. The eastern terminus of the Morris Canal had been Jersey City and Newark. The Swede knew of the Newark end of the canal from when he was a boy, and his father would remind him, if they were downtown or anywhere near Raymond Boulevard, that until as recently as the year the Swede was born, a real canal ran up by High Street near where the Jewish Y was and down to where there was now this wide city thoroughfare, Raymond Boulevard, leading traffic from Broad Street under Penn Station and out Old Passaic Avenue onto the Skyway. In the Swede's young mind, the Morris and Morris Canal never connected with Morris County, a place that seemed as remote as Nebraska then, but with his father's enterprising oldest brother, Morris. In 1918, at the age of 24, already the owner of a shoe store he ran with his young wife, a cubbyhole down neck on Ferry Street, amid all the poor Poles and Italians and Irish, and the family's greatest achievement until the wartime contract with the Wax put Newark made on the map, Morris had perished virtually overnight in the influenza epidemic. Even on his tour of the county that day, every time Orcutt mentioned the Morris Canal, the Swede thought first of the dead uncle he had never known, a beloved brother who was much missed by his father and for whom the child had come to believe the canal beneath Raymond Boulevard was named. Even when his father bought the Central Avenue factory, no more than 100 yards from the very spot where the canal had turned north toward Belleville, a factory that virtually backed on the city subway built beneath the old canal route, he persisted in associating the name of the canal with the story of the struggles of their family, rather than with the grander history of the state. After going around Washington's Morristown headquarters, where he politely pretended he hadn't already seen the muskets and the cannonballs and the old eyeglasses as a Newark fourth grader, he and Orcutt drove southwest a ways out of Morristown to a church cemetery dating back to the American Revolution. Soldiers killed in the war were buried there, as well as 27 soldiers buried in a common grave, who were victims of the smallpox epidemic that swept the encampments in the countryside in the spring of 1777. Out among those old, old tombstones, Orcutt was no less historically edifying than he'd been all morning on the road, so that at the dinner table that evening, when Dawn asked where Mr. Orcutt had taken him, the Swede laughed. "I got my money's worth, all right. The guy's a walking encyclopedia. I never felt so ignorant in my life." "How boring was it?" Dawn asked. "Or not at all," the Swede told her. "We had a good time. He's a good guy. Very nice. More there than you think when you first meet him. Much more to Orcutt than that old school tie." He was thinking particularly of the Easton whorehouse, but said instead, "Family goes back to the Revolution." "Well, doesn't that come as a surprise?" Dawn replied. "The guy knows everything," he said, feigning indifference to her sarcasm. "For instance, that old graveyard where we were? It's at the top of the tallest hill around, so the rain that falls on the northern roof of the old church there finds its way north to the Passaic River and eventually to Newark Bay, and the rain that falls on the southern side finds its way south through a branch of the Raritan, which eventually goes to New Brunswick." "I don't believe that," said Dawn. "Well, it's true." "I refuse to believe it. Not to New Brunswick." "Oh, don't be a kid, Dawn. It's interesting, geologically." Deliberately, he added, "Very interesting." To let her know he was having no part of the Irish resentment. It was beneath him, and happened also to be beneath her. In bed that night, he thought that when Mary got to be a schoolgirl, he'd inveigle Orcutt into taking her along on this very same trip, so she could learn firsthand the history of the county where she was growing up. He wanted her to see where, At the turn of the century, a railroad line used to run up into Morristown from White House to carry the peaches from the orchards in Huntington County. 30 miles of railroad line just to transport peaches. Among the well-to-do, there was a peach craze then in the big cities, and they'd ship them from Morristown into New York. The peach special. Wasn't that something? On a good day, 70 cars of peaches hauled from the Huntington orchards. 2 million peach trees down there before a blight carried them all away. But he could himself tell her about the train and the trees and the blight when the time came. Take her on his own to show her where the tracks used to be. It wouldn't require Orcutt to do it for him. The first Morris County Orcutt, Orcutt told him at the cemetery, pointing to a brown, weathered gravestone decorated at the top with the carving of a winged angel, a gravestone set close up to the back wall of the church. Thomas. Protestant immigrant from Northern Ireland, arrived 1774, age of 20. Enlisted in a local militia outfit, a private. January 2nd, 1777, fought at 2nd Trenton. Battle that set the stage for Washington's victory at Princeton the next day.
Didn't know that, the Swede said.
Wound up at the logistical base at Morristown, commissary support for the Continental Army artillery train. After the war, bought a Morristown ironworks, destroyed by a flash flood, 1795. Two flash floods, 94 and 95, big supporter of Jefferson. Political appointment from Governor Bloomfield saved his life. Surrogate of Morris County, master in chancery. Eventually, county clerk. There he is, the sturdy, fecund patriarch.
Interesting, said the Swede.
Interesting at just the moment he found it all about as deadly as it could get. How it was interesting was that he never met anybody like this before. Over here, said Orcutt, leading him some 20 feet up to another old brownish stone with an angel carved at the top, this one with an indecipherable rhyme of 4 lines inscribed near the bottom. His son, William. 10 sons. One died in his 30s, but the rest lived long lives, spread out all over Morris County. None of them farmers. Justices of the peace, sheriffs, freeholders, postmasters, Orcutts everywhere, even into Warren and up into Sussex. William was the prosperous one. Turnpike development, banking. New Jersey presidential elector in 1828 pledged to Andrew Jackson. Rode the Jackson victory to a big judicial appointment. State's highest judicial body. Never a member of the bar. That didn't matter then. Died a much respected judge. See, on the stone, a virtuous and useful citizen. It's his son, over here, this one here. His son, George, who clerked for August Finley and became a partner. Finley was a state legislator. Slavery issue drove him into the Republican Party. As the Swede told Dawn, whether she wanted to hear it or not, no, because she did not want to hear it, it was a lesson in American history. John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson. His grandfather was a classmate of Woodrow Wilson's at Princeton. He told me the class. I forget it now. 1879. I'm full of dates, Dawny. He told me everything, and all we were doing was walking around a cemetery out back of a church at the top of a hill. It was something. It was school. But once was enough. He'd paid all the attention he could, never stopped trying to keep straight in his mind the progress of the Orcutts through almost 2 centuries, though each time Orcutt had said Morris, as in Morris County, the Swede had thought Morris, as in Morris Lvov. He couldn't remember ever in his life feeling more like his father. Not like his father's son, but like his father. Than he did marching around the graves of those Orcutts. His family couldn't compete with Orcutts when it came to ancestors. They would have run out of ancestors in about 2 minutes. As soon as you got back earlier than Newark, back to the old country, no one knew anything. Earlier than Newark, they didn't know their names or anything about them, how anyone made a living, let alone whom they voted for. But Orcutt could spin out ancestors forever. Every rung into America for the Lvovs, there was another rung to attain. This guy was there. Is that why Orcutt had laid on a little thick? Was it to make clear what Dawn accused him of making clear simply by the way he smiled at you? Just who he was and just who you weren't? No, that was thinking not too much like Dawn, but way too much like his father. Jewish resentment could be just as bad as the Irish resentment. It could be worse. They hadn't moved out here to get caught up in that stuff. He was no Ivy Leaguer himself. He'd been educated, like Dawn, at lowly Uppsala in East Orange, and thought Ivy League was a name for a kind of clothes before he knew it had anything to do with the university. Little by little, the picture came into focus, of course. A world of Gentile wealth, where the buildings were covered with ivy, and the people had money and dressed in a certain style. Didn't admit Jews, didn't know Jews, probably didn't like Jews all that much. Maybe they didn't like Irish Catholics. He'd take Dawn's word for it. Maybe they looked down on them, too, but Orcutt was Orcutt. He had to be judged according to his own values and not the values of the Ivy League. As long as he's fair and respectful to me, I'll be fair and respectful to him. All it came down to, in his mind, was that the guy could get boring on the subject of the past. The Swede wasn't going to take it to mean more until somebody proved otherwise. They weren't out there to get all worked up about neighbors across the hill whose house they couldn't even see. They were out there because, as he liked to joke to his mother, I want to own the things that money can't buy. Everybody else who was picking up and leaving Newark was headed for one of the cozy suburban streets in Maplewood or South Orange, while they, by comparison, were out on the frontier. During the 2 years when he was down in South Carolina with the Marines, it used to thrill him to think, this is the old South. I'm below the Mason-Dixon line. I am down south. Well, he couldn't commute from down south, but he could skip Maplewood and South Orange, leapfrog the South Mountain Reservation, and just keep going. Get as far out west in New Jersey as he could while still being able to make it every day to Central Avenue in an hour. Why not? 100 acres of America. Land first cleared not for agriculture, but to furnish timber for those old iron forges that consumed 1,000 acres of timber a year. The real estate lady turned out to know almost as much local history as Bill Orcutt, and was no less generous in ladling it out to a potential buyer from the streets of Newark. A barn, a mill pond, a mill stream. The foundation remains of a grist mill that had supplied grain for Washington's troops. Back on the property somewhere, an abandoned iron mine. Just after the Revolution, the original house, a wood structure, and the sawmill had burned down and the house was replaced by this one, according to a date engraved on a stone over the cellar door and carved into a corner beam in the front room, built in 1786, its exterior walls constructed of stones collected from the fireplaces of the Revolutionary Army's former campsites in the local hills. A house of stone such as he had always dreamed of, with a gambrel roof, no less, and, in what used to be the kitchen and was now the dining room, a fireplace unlike any he'd ever seen, large enough for roasting an ox, fitted out with an oven door and a crane to swing an iron kettle around over the fire, a 19-inch-high lintel beam extending 17 feet across the whole width of the room, 4 smaller fireplaces in other rooms, all working with the original chimney pieces, the wooden carving and molding barely visible beneath coats and coats of 160-odd years of paint, but waiting there to be restored and revealed. A central hallway 10 feet wide, a staircase with newel post and railings carved of pale, striped tiger maple. According to the real estate lady, tiger maple a rarity in these parts at that time. 2 rooms to either side of the staircase, both upstairs and downstairs, making in all 8 rooms, plus the kitchen, plus the big back porch. Why the hell shouldn't it be his? Why shouldn't he own it? I don't want to live next door to anybody. I've done that. I grew up doing that. I don't want to see the stoop out the window. I want to see the land. I want to see the streams running everywhere. I want to see the cows and the horses. You drive down the road, there's a falls there. We don't have to live like everybody else. We can live any way we want to now. We did it. Nobody stopped us. They couldn't. We're married. We can go anywhere. We can do anything. Donnie, we're free. Moreover, getting to be free had not been painless. What with the pressure from his father to buy in the Newstead development in suburban South Orange, to buy a modern house with everything in it brand new instead of a decrepit mausoleum. You'll never heed it, predicted Lou Lavov the Saturday he first laid eyes on the huge vacant old stone house with the for sale sign. A house on a hilly country road out in the middle of nowhere, 11 miles west of the nearest train stop, the Lackawanna station in Morristown, where the screen-door green cars with the yellowish cane seats took people all the way into New York. Because it came with 100 acres and with a collapsing barn and a fallen-down grist mill, because it had been vacant and up for sale for almost a year, it was going for about half the price of things that sat on just a 2-acre lot in Newstead. Heat this place cost you a fortune, and you'll still freeze to death. When it snows out here, Seymour, how are you going to get to the train? On these roads, you're not.
What the hell does he need all that ground for anyway? Lou Lvov demanded of the Swede's mother, who was standing between the two men in her coat and trying her best to stay out of the discussion by studying the tops of the roadside trees. Or so the Swede thought. Later he learned that, in vain, she had been looking down the road for streetlights. What are you going to do with all that ground? His father asked him. Feed the starving Armenians? You know what? You're dreaming. I wonder if you even know where this is. Let's be candid with each other about this. This is a narrow, bigoted area. The Klan thrived out here in the 20s. Did you know that? The Ku Klux Klan. People had crosses burned on their property out here. Dad, the Ku Klux Klan doesn't exist anymore. Oh, doesn't it? This is rock-ribbed Republican New Jersey. It's Republican out here from top to bottom. Dad, Eisenhower is president. The whole country is Republican. Eisenhower is the president, and Roosevelt is dead. Yeah, and this place was Republican when Roosevelt was living. Republican during the New Deal. Think about that. Why did they hate Roosevelt out here, Seymour? I don't know why, because he was a Democrat. No, they didn't like Roosevelt because they didn't like the Jews and the Italians and the Irish. That's why they moved out here to begin with. They didn't like Roosevelt because he accommodated himself to these new Americans. He understood what they needed and he tried to help them, but not these bastards. They wouldn't give a Jew the time of day. I'm talking to you, son, about bigots. Not about the goose step, even, just about hate. And this is where the haters live, out here. The answer was Newstead. In Newstead, he would not have the headache of 100 acres. In Newstead, it would be rock-ribbed Democrat. In Newstead, he could live with his family among young Jewish couples, the baby could grow up with Jewish friends, and the commute door-to-door to Newark May, taking South Orange Avenue straight in, was half an hour tops. Dad, I drive to Morristown in 15 minutes. Not if it snows, you don't. Not if you obey the traffic laws, you don't. The 828 Express gets me to Broad Street, 856. I walk to Central Avenue, and I'm at work 6 minutes after nine. And if it snows? You still haven't answered me. If the train breaks down. Stockbrokers take this train to work. Lawyers, businessmen who go into Manhattan, wealthy people. It's not the milk train. It doesn't break down. On the early morning trains, they've got their own parlor car, for God's sake. It's not the sticks. But you could have fooled me, his father replied. But the Swede, rather like some frontiersmen of old, would not be turned back. What was impractical and ill-advised to his father was an act of bravery to him. Next to marrying Dawn Dwyer, buying that house and the 100 acres and moving out to Old Rim Rock was the most daring thing he had ever done. What was Mars to his father was America to him. He was settling revolutionary New Jersey as if for the first time, out in Old Rimrock. All of America lay at their door. That was an idea he loved. Jewish resentment, Irish resentment, to hell with it. A husband and wife, each just 25 years of age, a baby of less than a year. It had been courageous of them to head out to Old Rimrock. He had already heard tell of more than a few strong, intelligent, talented guys in the leatherware business beaten down by their fathers, and he was not going to let it happen to him. He'd fallen in love with the same business as his old man had taken his birthright, and now he was moving beyond it to damn well live where he wanted. No, we are not going to have anybody's resentment. We are 35 miles out beyond that resentment. He wasn't saying it was always easy to blend across religious borders. He wasn't saying there wasn't prejudice. He'd faced it as a recruit in the Marine Corps. In boot camp, on a couple of occasions, faced it head-on and faced it down. She had her own brush with blatant anti-Semitism at the pageant in Atlantic City, when a chaperone referred distastefully to 1945 when Bess Meyerson became Miss America as the year the Jewish girl won. She heard plenty of casual cracks about Jews as a kid, but Atlantic City was the real world, and it shocked her. She wouldn't repeat it at the time because she was fearful that he would turn against her for remaining politely silent and failing to tell the stupid woman where to get off, especially when her chaperone added, "I grant she was good-looking, but it was a great embarrassment to the pageant nonetheless." Not that it mattered one way or the other anymore. Dawn was a mere contestant, 22 years old. What could she have said or done? His point was that they were both aware from first-hand experience that these prejudices existed. In a community as civilized as Old Rimrock, however, differences of religion didn't have to be as hard to deal with as Dawn was making them. If she could marry a Jew, she could surely be a friendly neighbor to a Protestant. Sure as hell could if a husband could.
The Protestants are just another denomination. Maybe they were rare where she grew up. They were rare where he grew up, too. But they happen not to be rare in America. Let's face it, they are America.
But if you do not assert the superiority of the Catholic way the way your mother does, and I do not assert the superiority of the Jewish way the way my father does, I'm sure we'll find plenty of people out here who won't assert the superiority of the Protestant way the way their fathers and mothers did.
Nobody dominates anybody anymore. That's what the war was about. Our parents are not attuned to the possibilities, to the realities of the post-war world where people can live in harmony. All sorts of people, side by side, no matter what their origins. This is a new generation, and there's no need for that resentment stuff from anybody, them or us. And the upper class is nothing to be frightened of either. You know what you're going to find once you know them? That they are just other people who want to get along. Let's be intelligent about this. As it worked out, he never had to make a case as thorough as this to get Dawn to lay off about Orcutt, since Orcutt was never much in their lives after the sightseeing trip that Dawn kept referring to as the Orcutt family cemetery tour. Nothing like a social life developed back then between the Orcutts and the Lebovs. Not even a casual friendship. Though the Swede did show up Saturday mornings at the pasture back of Orcutt's house for the weekly touch football game with Orcutt's local friends and some other fellows like the Swede, ex-GIs from around Essex County trickling out with new families to the wide open spaces. Among them was an optician named Bucky Robinson, a short, muscular, pigeon-toed guy with a round, angelic face who had been second-string quarterback for Hillside High, Weekwake's traditional Thanksgiving Day rival when Swede was finishing high school. The first week Bucky showed up, the Swede overheard him telling Orcutt about Swede LeBeouf's senior year, enumerating on his fingers all-city and in football, all-city, all-county center in basketball, all-city, all-county, all-state first baseman in baseball. Though ordinarily the Swede would have found this awe of him so nakedly demonstrated, not at all to his liking in an environment where he only wished to inspire neighborly goodwill, where being just another one of the guys who showed up to play ball was fine with him, he seemed not to mind that Orcutt was the one standing there enduring the excess of Bucky's enthusiasm. He had no quarrel with Orcutt and no reason to have any, yet seeing everything he would ordinarily prefer to hide behind a modest demeanor being revealed so passionately to Orcutt by Bucky was more pleasurable than he might have imagined, almost like the satisfaction of a desire he personally knew nothing about, a desire for revenge. When, for several weeks running, Bucky and the Swede wound up together on the same team, the newcomer couldn't believe his good fortune. While to everybody else the new neighbor was Seymour, Bucky at every opportunity called him Swede. Didn't matter who else might be in the clear. Wildly waving his arms in the air, the Swede was the receiver Bucky saw. "Big Swede, way to go!" he'd shout whenever the Swede came back to the huddle, having gathered in yet another Robinson pass. Big Swede, which nobody but Jerry had called him since high school. And with Jerry, it was always sardonic. One day, Bucky hitched a ride with the Swede to a local garage where his car was being repaired, and as they were driving along, announced surprisingly that he was Jewish, too, and that he and his wife had recently become members of a Morristown temple. Out here, he said, they were more and more involving themselves with the Morristown Jewish community. It can be very sustaining in a Gentile town, Bucky told the Swede, to know you have Jewish friends nearby. Though not enormous, Morristown's was an established Jewish community, went back to before the Civil War, and included quite a few of the town's influential people, among them a trustee at Morristown Memorial Hospital, through whose insistence the first Jewish doctors had, 2 years back, finally been invited to join the hospital staff, and the owner of the town's best department store. Successful Jewish families had been living in the big stucco houses on Western Avenue for 50 years now, though on the whole, this wasn't an area known to be terribly friendly toward Jews. As a child, Bucky had been taken by his family up to Mount Freedom, the resort town in the nearby hills, where they would stay for a week each summer at Lieberman's Hotel, and where Bucky first fell in love with the beauty and serenity of the Morris countryside. Up at Mount Freedom, needless to say, it was great for Jews. 10, 11 large hotels that were all Jewish, a summer turnover in the tens of thousands that was entirely Jewish. The vacationers themselves jokingly referred to the place as Mount Freedman. If you lived in an apartment in Newark or Passaic or Jersey City, a week in Mount Freedom was heaven.
In Espamorristown, although solidly Gentile, it was nonetheless a cosmopolitan community of lawyers, doctors, and stockbrokers, where Bucky and his wife loved going to the movies at the community, loved the shops, which were excellent, loved the beautiful old buildings, and where there were the Jewish shopkeepers with their neon signs up and down Speedwell Avenue. But did the Swede know that before the war there had been a swastika scrawled on the golf course sign at the edge of Mount Freedom? Did he know that the Klan held meetings in Boontown and Dover, rural people, working-class people, members of the Klan? Did he know that crosses were burned on people's lawns not 5 miles from the Morristown Green? From that day on, Bucky kept trying to land the Swede, who would have been a considerable catch, and to haul him in for the Morristown Jewish community to get him, if not to join the temple outright, at least to play evening basketball in the interchurch league for the team the temple fielded. Robinson's mission irritated the Swede in just the way his mother had when, some months after Dawn became pregnant, she astonished him by asking if Dawn was going to convert before the baby was born. "A man to whom practicing Judaism means nothing, Mother, doesn't ask his wife to convert." He had never been so stern with her in his life, and, to his dismay, she had walked away near tears, and it had taken numerous hugs throughout the day to get her to understand that he wasn't angry with her. He had only been making clear that he was a grown man with the prerogatives of a grown man. Now, with Dawn, he talked about Robinson. Talked a lot about him as they lay in bed at night. "I didn't come out here for that stuff. I never got that stuff, anyway. I used to go on the high holidays with my father, and I never understood what they were getting at. Even seeing my father there never made sense. It wasn't him. It wasn't like him. He was bending to something that he didn't have to, something he didn't even understand. He was just bending to this because of my grandfather. I never understood what any of that stuff had to do with his being a man. What the glove factory had to do with his being a man, anybody could understand, just about everything. My father knew what he was talking about when he was talking about gloves. But when he started about that stuff, you should have heard him. If he had known as little about leather as he knew about God, the family would have wound up in the poorhouse. Oh, but Bucky Robinson isn't talking about God, Seymour. He wants to be your friend," she said. "That's all. I guess. But I was never interested in that stuff, Donnie. Back for as long as I can remember, I never understood it. Does anybody? I don't know what they're talking about. I go into those synagogues, and it's all foreign to me. It always has been. When I had to go to Hebrew school as a kid, all the time I was in that room, I couldn't wait to get out on the ball field. I used to think, if I sit in this room any longer, I'm going to get sick. There was something unhealthy about those places. Anywhere near any of those places, and I knew it wasn't where I wanted to be. The factory was a place I wanted to be from the time I was a boy. The ball field was a place I wanted to be from the time I started kindergarten. That this is a place where I want to be, I knew from the moment I laid eyes on it. Why shouldn't I be where I want to be? Why shouldn't I be with who I want to be? Isn't that what this country's all about? I want to be where I want to be, and I don't want to be where I don't want to be. That's what being an American is, isn't it? I'm with you, I'm with the baby, I'm at the factory during the day. The rest of the time, I'm out here, and that's everywhere in this world I ever want to be. We own a piece of America, Dawn. I couldn't be happier if I tried. I did it. Darling, I did it. I did what I set out to do." For a while, the Swede stopped showing up at the touch football games just to avoid having to deflect Bucky Robinson on the subject of his temple. With Robinson, he did not feel like his father. He felt like Orcutt. No. You know whom he really felt like? Not during the hour or two a week he happened to be on the receiving end of a Bucky Robinson pass, but whom he felt like all the rest of the time? He couldn't tell anybody, of course. He was 26 and a new father, and people would have laughed at the childishness of it. He laughed at it himself. It was one of those kid things you keep in your mind no matter how old you get. But whom he felt like out in old Rimrock was Johnny Appleseed. Who cares about Bill Orcutt? Woodrow Wilson knew Orcutt's grandfather. Thomas Jefferson knew his grandfather's uncle. Good for Bill Orcutt. Johnny Appleseed, that's the man for me. Wasn't a Jew, wasn't an Irish Catholic, wasn't a Protestant Christian. Nope, Johnny Appleseed was just a happy American. Big, ruddy, happy, no brains probably, but didn't need them. A great walker was all Johnny Appleseed needed to be. All physical joy. He had a big stride and a bag of seeds and a huge, spontaneous affection for the landscape, and everywhere he went, he scattered the seeds. What a story that was. Going everywhere, walking everywhere. The Swede had loved that story all his life. Who wrote it? Nobody, as far as he could remember. They just studied it in grade school. Johnny Appleseed, out there everywhere, planting apple trees. That bag of seeds. I loved that bag. Though maybe it was his hat. Did he keep the seeds in his hat? Didn't matter. Who told him to do it? Murray asked him when she got old enough for bedtime stories. Though still baby enough, should he try to tell any other story, like the one about the train that used to carry only peaches, to cry, "Johnny! I want Johnny!" Who told him? Nobody told him, sweetheart. You don't have to tell Johnny Appleseed to plant trees. He just takes it on himself. Who's his wife? Dawn. Dawn Appleseed. That's who his wife is. Does he have a child? Oh, sure he has a child. And you know what her name is? What? Mary Appleseed. Does she plant apple seeds in a hat? Sure she does. Well, she doesn't plant them in the hat, honey. She stores them in the hat. Then she throws them. Far as she can, she casts them out. And everywhere she throws the seed, wherever it lands on the ground, do you know what happens? What? An apple tree grows up right there. And every time he walked into Old Rimrock Village, he couldn't restrain himself. First thing on the weekend, he pulled on his boots and walked the 5 hilly miles into the village and the 5 hilly miles back. Early in the morning, walked all the way just to get the Saturday paper, and he couldn't help himself. He thought, Johnny Appleseed. The pleasure of it, the pure, buoyant, unrestrained pleasure of striding. He didn't care if he played ball ever again. He just wanted to step out and stride. It seemed somehow that the ball playing had cleared the way to allow him to do this, to stride in an hour down to the village, pick up the Lackawanna edition of the Newark News at the general store, with a single Sunoco pump out front and the produce out on the steps in boxes and burlap bags. It was the only store down there in the 50s, and hadn't changed since the Hamlin son Russ took it over from his father after World War I. They sold washboards and tops. There was a sign up outside for Frosty, a soft drink, another nail to the clapboards for Fleischmann's yeast, another for Pittsburgh paint products, even one out front that said Syracuse plows, hanging there from when the store sold farm equipment, too. Russ Hamlin could remember from earliest boyhood a wheelwright shop perched across the way, could still recall watching wagon wheels roll down a ramp to be cooled in the stream. Remembered, too, when there was a distillery out back, one of many in the region that had made famous the local Applejack and had shut down only with the passage of the Volstead Act. Clear at the back of the store, there was one window that was the U.S. Post Office. One window was it, and 30 or so of those boxes with the combination locks. Hamlin's General Store, with the post office inside and outside, the bulletin board and the flagpole and the gas pump, that's what had served the old farming community as its meeting place since the days of Warren Gamaliel Harding, when Russ became proprietor. Diagonally across the street, alongside where there'd been the wheelwright shop, was the 6-room schoolhouse that would be the LaBeouf's daughter's first school. Kids sat on the steps of the store. Your girl would meet you there. A meeting place, a greeting place. The Swede loved it. The familiar old Newark News he picked up had a special section out here, the second section called Along the Lackawanna. Even that pleased him, and not just reading through it at home for the local Morris News, but merely carrying it home in his hand. The word Lackawanna was pleasing to him in and of itself. From the front counter, he'd pick up the paper with LaBeouf scrawled at the top in Mary Hamlin's hand, charge a quart of milk if they needed it, a loaf of bread, a dozen fresh laid eggs from Paul Hamlin's farm up the road, and say, "See you, Russell," to the owner. And then he'd turn and stride all the way back past the white pasture fences he loved, the rolling hay fields he loved, the cornfields, the turnip fields, the barns, the horses, the cows, the ponds, the streams, the springs, the falls, the watercress, the scouring rushes, the meadows, the acres and acres of woods he loved with all of a new country dweller's puppy love for nature, until he reached the century-old maple trees he loved and the substantial old stone house he loved, pretending as he went along to throw the apple seed everywhere. Once, from an upstairs window, Dawn saw him approaching the house from the foot of their hill while he was doing just that, flinging out one arm, flinging it out, not as though he were throwing a ball or swinging a bat, but as though he were pulling handfuls of seeds from the grocery bag and throwing them with all his strength across the face of the historic land that was now no less his than it was William Orcutt's. "What are you practicing out there?" she said, laughing at him when he burst into the bedroom, looking, from all that exercise, handsome as hell, big, carnal, ruddy as Johnny Appleseed himself, someone to whom something marvelous was happening. When people raise their glasses and toast a youngster, when they say to him, "May you have health and good fortune," the picture they have in mind, or that they should have in mind, is of the earthy human specimen, the very image of unrestricted virility, who burst so happily into that bedroom and found there all alone a little magnificent beast, his young wife, stripped of all maidenly constraints and purely blissfully his. "Seymour, what are you doing down at Hamlin's? Taking ballet lessons?" Easily, so easily, with those large, protecting hands of his, he raised the 103 pounds of her up from the floor where she stood barefoot in a nightgown, and using all his considerable strength, he held her to him as though he were holding together, binding together, into one unshatterable entity, the wonderful, new, irreproachable existence of husband and father, Seymour LeVove, Arcady Hill Road, Old Rimrock, New Jersey, USA. What he had been doing out on the road, which as though it were a shameful or superficial endeavor, he couldn't bring himself openly to confess even to Dawn, was making love to his life. About the intensity of his physical intimacy with his young wife, he was actually more discreet. Together, they were rather prudish around people, and no one would have guessed at the secret that was their sexual life. Before Dawn, he had never slept with anybody he dated. He slept with two whores while he was in the Marine Corps, but that didn't count really, and so only after they were married did they discover how passionate he could be. He had tremendous stamina and tremendous strength, and her smallness next to his largeness, the way he could lift her up, the bigness of his body in bed with her seemed to excite them both. She said that when he would fall asleep after making love, she felt as though she was sleeping with a mountain. It thrilled her sometimes to think she was sleeping beside an enormous rock. When she was lying under him, he would plunge in and out of her very hard, but at the same time holding himself at a distance so she would not be crushed. And because of his stamina and strength, he could keep this up for a long time without getting tired. With one arm, he could pick her up and turn her around on her knees, or he could sit her on his lap and move easily under the weight of 103 pounds. For months and months following their marriage, she would begin to cry after she had reached her orgasm. She would come, and she would cry, and he didn't know what to make of it. "What's the matter?" he asked her. "I don't know." "Do I hurt you?" "No, I don't know where it comes from. It's almost as if the sperm, when you shoot it into my body, sets off the tears. But I don't hurt you." "No." "Does it please you, Donnie? Do you like it?" "I love it. There's something about it. It just gets to a place that nothing else gets to. And that's the place where the tears are. You reach a part of me that nothing else ever reaches." "Okay, as long as I don't hurt you." "No, no, it's just strange. It's just strange. It's just strange not being alone," she said. She stopped crying only when he went down on her for the first time. "You don't cry this way," he said. "It was so different," she said. "How? Why?" "I guess I don't know. I guess I'm alone again." "Do you want me not to do it again?" "Oh, no," she laughed. "Absolutely not." "Okay. Seymour, how did you know how to do that? Did you ever do that before?" "Never." "Why did you then? Tell me." But he couldn't explain things as well as she could, and so he didn't try. He was just overtaken by the desire to do something more. And so he lifted her buttocks in one hand and raised her body
into his mouth, to stick his face there and just go. Go to where he had never been before. Ecstatically complicitous, he and Dawn. He had no reason to believe she would ever do it for him, of course, and then one Sunday morning, she just did it. He didn't know what to think. His little Dawn put her beautiful little mouth around his cock. He was stunned. They both were. It was taboo for both of them. From then on, it just went on for years and years. It never stopped. "There's something so touching about you," she whispered to him, "when you get to the point where you're out of control." So touching to her, she told him, this very restrained, good, polite, well-brought-up man, a man always so in charge of his strength, who had mastered his tremendous strength and had no violence in him. When he got past the point of no return, beyond the point of anyone's being embarrassed about anything, when he was beyond the point of being able to judge her or to think that somehow she was a bad girl for wanting it as much as she wanted it from him, then when he just wanted it, those last 3 or 4 minutes that would culminate in the screaming orgasm. "It makes me feel so extremely feminine," she told him. "It makes me feel extremely powerful. It makes me feel both." When she got out of bed after they made love, and she looked wildly disheveled, flushed and with her hair all over the place and her eye makeup smudged and her lips swollen, and she went off into the bathroom to pee, he would follow her there and lift her off the seat after she had wiped herself and look at the two of them together in the bathroom mirror, and she would be taken aback as much as he was, not simply by how beautiful she looked, how beautiful the fucking allowed her to look, but how other she looked. The social face was gone. There was Dawn. But all this was a secret from others and had to be, particularly from the child. Sometimes after Dawn had been all day on her feet with the cows, he would pull his chair up to hers after dinner and he would rub her feet and Mary would make a face and say, "Oh, Daddy, that's disgusting." But that was the only truly demonstrative thing they ever did in front of her. Otherwise, there was just the usual affectionate stuff around the house that kids expect to see from their parents and would miss if it didn't go on. The life they led together behind their bedroom door was a secret about which their daughter knew no more than anyone else. And on it went, on and on for years. It never stopped until the bomb went off and Dawn wound up in the hospital. After she came out was when it began stopping. Orcutt had married the granddaughter of one of his grandfather's law partners at Orcutt Findlay, the Morristown firm that he had been expected to join. After graduating from Princeton, he had declined, however, to accept a place at Harvard Law School. Princeton and Harvard Law had for over 100 years constituted the education of an Orcutt boy, and breaking with the traditions of the world he'd been born to, he moved to a lower Manhattan studio to become an abstract painter and a new man. Only after 3 depressive years feverishly painting behind the dirty windows over the truck traffic on Hudson Street did he marry Jessie and come back to Jersey to begin architecture studies at Princeton. He never relinquished entirely his dream of an artistic calling, and though his architectural work, mostly on the restoration of the 18th and 19th century houses out in their moneyed quarter of Morris County and from Somerset and Huntington counties all the way down through Bucks County in Pennsylvania, the converting of old barns into elegant Ruston homes, kept him happily occupied. Every 3 or 4 years there was an exhibition of his at a Morristown frame shop that the Lvovs, always flattered to be invited to the opening, faithfully attended. The suite was never so uncomfortable in any social situation as he was standing in front of Orcutt's paintings, which was said by the flyer you got at the door to be influenced by Chinese calligraphy, but looked like nothing much to him, not even Chinese. Right from the beginning, Dawn had found them thought-provoking. To her, they showed a most unlikely side to Bill Orcutt, a sensitivity she'd never seen a single indicator of before. But the thought the exhibition most provoked in the Swede was how long he should continue pretending to look at one of the canvases before moving on to pretend to be looking at another one. All he really had any inclination to do was to lean forward and read the titles pasted up on the wall beside each painting, thinking they might help. But when he did, despite Dawn's telling him not to, pulling his jacket and whispering, "Forget those, look at the brushwork," he was only more disheartened than when he did look at the brushwork. Composition number 16. Picture number 6. Meditation number 11. Untitled number 12. And what was there on the canvas but a band of long gray smears so pale across a white background that it looked as though Orcutt had tried not to paint the painting but to rub it out? Consulting the description of the exhibition in the flyer, written and signed by the young couple who owned the frame shop, didn't do any good either. Orcutt's calligraphy is so intense, the shapes dissolve. Then, in the glow of its own energy, the brushstroke dissolves itself. Why on earth would a guy like Orcutt, no stranger to the natural world and the great historical drama of this country, and a hell of a tennis player, why on earth did he want to paint pictures of nothing? Since the Swede had to figure the guy wasn't a phony, why would someone as well-educated and as self-confident as Orcutt devote all this effort to being a phony? He could, for a while, put the confusion down to his own ignorance about art. Intermittently, the Swede might continue to think, there's something wrong with this guy. There's some big dissatisfaction there. This Orcutt doesn't have what he wants, but then the Swede would read something like that flyer and realize that he didn't know what he was talking about. 2 decades after the Greenwich Village years, Orcutt's ambition remains lofty. To create, the flyer concluded, a personal expression of universal themes that include the enduring moral dilemmas which define the human condition. It never occurred to the Swede, reading the flyer, that enough could not be claimed for the paintings just because they were so hollow, that you had to say they were pictures of everything because they were pictures of nothing, that all those words were merely another way of saying Orcutt was talentless and, however earnestly he might try, could never hammer out for himself an artistic prerogative or, for that matter, any but the prerogative whose rigid definitions had swaddled him at birth. It didn't occur to the Swede that he was right, that this guy who seemed so at one with himself, so perfectly attuned to the place where he lived and the people around him, might be inadvertently divulging that to be out of tune was, in fact, a secret and long-standing desire he hadn't the remotest idea of how to achieve except by oddly striving to paint paintings that looked like they didn't look like anything. Apparently, the best he could do with his craving to be otherwise was this stuff. Sad. Anyway, it didn't matter how sad it was, or what the Swede did or did not ask or understand or know about the painter, once one of those calligraphic paintings expressing the universal themes that define the human condition made its way onto the Lvov living room wall a month after Dawn returned from Geneva with her new face. And that's when things got a little sad for the Swede. It was a band of brown streaks, and not gray ones, that Orcutt had been trying to rub out of meditation number 27, and the background was purplish rather than white. The dark colors, according to Dawn, signaled a revolution of the painter's formal means. That's what she told him, and the Swede, not knowing quite how to respond and with no interest in what formal means meant, settled blamely on interesting. They didn't have any art hanging on the walls when he was a kid, let alone modern art. Art hadn't existed in his house any more than it did in Dawn's. The Dwyers had religious pictures, which might even be what accounted for Dawn's having all of a sudden become a connoisseur of formal means. A secret embarrassment about growing up where, aside from the framed photos of Dawn and her kid brother, the only pictures were pictures of the Virgin Mary and of Jesus' heart. These tasteful people have modern art on the wall. We are going to have modern art on the wall. Formal means on the wall. However much Dawn might deny it, wasn't there something of that going on here? Irish envy? She bought the painting right out of Orcutt's studio for exactly half as much as it had cost them to buy Count when he was a baby bull. The Swede told himself, forget the dough, write it off. You can't compare a bull to a painting. And in this way managed to control his disappointment when he saw meditation number 27 go up on the very spot where once there had been the portrait of Mary that he loved, a painstakingly perfect, if somewhat overly pinkish likeness of the glowing child and blonde bangs she had been at six. It had been painted in oils for them by a jovial old gent down in New Hope who wore a smock and a beret in his studio there. He'd taken the time to serve them mulled wine and tell them about his apprenticeship copying paintings in the Louvre, and who'd come to the house six times for Mary to sit for him at the piano and wanted only 2,000 smackers for the painting and the gilt frame. But as the suite was told, since Orcutt hadn't asked for the additional 30% it would have cost had they purchased number 27 from the frame shop, the $5,000 was a bargain. His father's comment when he saw the new painting was, "How much did I charge you for that?" With reluctance, Don replied, $5,000. "Awful lot of money for a first coat. What's it going to be?" "Going to be?" Don had replied sourly. "Well, it ain't finished. I hope it ain't, is it?"
"That it isn't finished," said Don, "is the idea, Lou."
"Yeah." He looked again. "Well, if the guy ever wants to finish it, I can tell him how."
"Dad," said the sweet, to forestall further criticism, "Dawn bought it because she likes it." And though he also could have told the guy how to finish it, probably in words close to those his father had in mind, he was more than willing to hang anything Dawn bought from Orcutt just because she had bought it. Irish envy or no Irish envy, the painting was another sign that the desire to live had become stronger in her than the wish to die that had put her into the psychiatric clinic twice. "So the picture is shit," he told his father later. "The thing is, she wanted it. The thing is, she wants again." "Please," he warned him, feeling himself strangely given the slightness of the provocation at the edge of anger. "Please, no more about that picture." And Lou Lavov, being Lou Lavov, the next time he visited Old Rimrock, the first thing he did was walk up to the picture and say loudly, "You know something? I like that thing. I'm getting used to it. And I like it." "Look," he said to his wife, "look at how the guy didn't finish it. You see that? Where it's blurry? He did that on purpose. That's art." In the back of Orcutt's van was his large cardboard model of the new Lavov house, ready to unveil to the guest after dinner. Sketches and blueprints had been piling up in Dawn's study for weeks now, among them a diagram prepared by Orcutt charting how sunlight would angle into the windows on the first day of each month of the year. "A flood of sunlight," said Dawn. "Light," she exclaimed, "light." And if not with the brutal directness that could truly test to the limit his understanding of his suffering and of the panacea she devised, by implication, she was damning yet again the stone house he loved, and too, the old maple trees he loved, the giant trees that shaded the house against the summer heat, and every autumn ceremoniously cloaked the lawn in a golden wreath, at whose heart he'd hung Mary's swing once upon a time. The Swede couldn't get over those trees in the first years out in Old Rimrock. "I own those trees." It was more astonishing to him that he owned trees than that he owned factories. More astonishing that he owned trees than that a child of the Chancellor Avenue playing field and the unbucolic Wigwag streets should own the stately old stone house in the hills where Washington had twice made his winter camp during the Revolutionary War. It was puzzling to own trees. They weren't owned the way a business is owned or even a house is owned. If anything, they were held in trust. In trust. Yes, for all of posterity, beginning with Mary and her kids. To protect against ice storms and high winds, he had cables installed in each of the big maples, four cables forming a rough parallelogram against the sky where the heavy branches opened dramatically out some 50 feet up. The lightning rods that snaked from the trunk to the topmost point of each tree, he arranged to have inspected annually, just to be on the safe side. Twice a year the trees were sprayed against insects. Every third year they were fertilized, and regularly an arborist came around to prune out the dead wood and check the overall health of the private park beyond their door. Mary's trees. Mary's family's trees. In the fall,
just as he had always planned it, he'd be sure to get home from work before the sun went down, and there she would be, just as he had planned it, swinging high up over the fallen leaves encircling the maple by the front door, that largest tree, from which he first suspended that swing for her when she was only two. Up she would swing, nearly into the leaves of the branches that spread just beyond the panes of their bedroom windows, and though to him those precious moments at the end of each day had symbolized the realization of his every hope, to her they had meant not a goddamn thing. She turned out to love the trees no more than Dawn had loved the house. What she worried about was Algeria. She loved Algeria. The kid in that swing, the kid in that tree, the kid in that tree who is now on the floor of that room.
The Orcutts had come early so that Bill and Dawn would have time together to go over the problem of the link that was to join the one-story house to the two-story garage. Orcutt had been away in New York for a couple of days, and Dawn was impatient to get this, their last problem, resolved after weeks of thinking and rethinking how to create a harmonious relationship between the very different buildings. Even if the garage was more or less disguised as a barn, Dawn didn't want it too close, overwhelming the distinctiveness of the house. But she was afraid that a link 24 feet long, which was Orcutt's proposal, might impart the look of a motel. They ruminated together almost daily, not only over the dimensions, but now over whether the effect should perhaps be that of a greenhouse rather than of the simple passageway first planned. Whenever Dawn felt that Orcutt was trying to impose on her, however graciously, a solution that had more to do with some old-fashioned architectural aesthetic of his own than with the rigorous modernity she had in mind for their new home, she could be quite peeved, and she even wondered, on those few occasions when she was outright furious with him, if it hadn't been a mistake to turn to someone who, though he had considerable authority with local contractors, guaranteeing a first-class construction job and an excellent professional reputation, was essentially a restorer of antiques. Years had passed since she'd been intimidated by the snobbery that, fresh from Elizabeth and the family home, and the pictures on the wall and the statue in the hallway, she'd taken to be more or less Orcutt's whole story. Now, his credentials as county gentry were what she was most cutting about when the two of them were at odds. The angry disdain disappeared, however, when Orcutt came back to her, usually within 24 hours, having alighted on, in Dawn's words, a perfectly elegant plan, whether it was for the location of the washer-dryer, or a bathroom skylight, or the stairway to the guest room above the garage. Orcutt had brought with him, along with the large 1/16-inch scale model out in the van, samples of a new transparent plastic material he wanted her to consider for the walls and the roof of the link. He'd gone into the kitchen to show it to her. And there the two of them remained, the resourceful architect and the exacting client, debating all over again, while Dawn cleaned the lettuce, sliced the tomatoes, shucked the 2 dozen ears of corn the Orcutts had brought over in a bag from their garden, the pros and cons of a transparent link rather than the board and batten enclosure Orcutt had first proposed to unify it with the exterior of the garage. And meanwhile, on the back terrace that looked out toward the hill where, in another time, on an evening like this one, Dawn's herd would be silhouetted against the flamboyance of the late summer sunset, the Swede prepared the barbecue coals. Keeping him company were his father and Jesse Orcutt, who rarely these days was seen out socializing with Bill, but who, according to Dawn, was going through what had wearily been described by Orcutt phoning to ask if they wouldn't mind his wife coming along with him for dinner, as the calm that heralds the manic upswing. The Orcutts had 3 boys and 2 girls, all grown now, living and working at jobs in New York, 5 kids to whom Jessie, from all reports, had been a conscientious mother. It was after they'd gone that the heavy drinking began, at first only to lift her spirits, then to suppress her misery, and in the end, for its own sake. Yet back when the two couples had first met, it was Jesse's soundness that had impressed the Swede. So fresh, so outdoorsy, so cheerily at one with life, not the least bit false or insipid. Well, that's how she struck the Swede, if not his wife. Jessie was a Philadelphia heiress, a finishing school girl, who always during the day and sometimes in the evening wore her mud-spattered job frizz and who generally had her hair arranged in flossy flaxen braids.
What with those braids and her pure, round, unblemished face, behind which, said Dawn, if you bit into it, you'd find not a brain, but a Macintosh apple, she could have passed for Minnesota farm girl well into her 40s, except on those days when her hair was one up, and she could look as much like a young boy as like a young girl.